I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackin.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Smith from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. This will be our last podcast for 2017. We'll be taking a little bit of a break over Christmas and New Year, and we'll be back sort of mid-January time, I should think. But we've still got a really special show for you today. In fact, we've got two guests on the show. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, I mentioned we've got two guests. Normally we just go with the one guest, but we have Matt Hender from the world of volleyball and Chris Sorella, the retiring Kookaburra, looking back on his career with the Australian men's hockey team. So two really good guests today, one at the start of his career and one at the end of his career. But John, there's been plenty happening in sport.
Absolutely. Ashes, we've had the Ashes, Hockey World League Finals, which Australia won. Congratulations to the Kookaburras, back to back.
Rugby League World Cup, which Australia won, men's and women's.
Yeah, that's another discussion point, that one. Plenty more too, there's been just heaps going on.
Well, let's touch on first of all the cricket. We had the Adelaide Test Match, which was a day-night Test Match. Mm-hmm. The first time in Ashes history they'd had that. And I, as you know, I'm a staunch traditionalist when it comes to cricket. But I got to say, I was really happy with that. And I'll tell you the reason why. Was one, I felt that the wickets here are so dead and they're so sort of one-dimensional. There's not a lot of movement for the bowlers. There's not a lot in it for the bowlers until you get to day maybe four or five, sometimes day three. So it just becomes like a road for the batsman. But when you brought in that day-night component and the pink ball, suddenly the ball started to move around a little bit more, and it added another dimension to the game, and it suddenly became a contest between bat and ball. And so I was like, wow, I actually really liked it. I was really pleased with it. And I was talking to some of the English media that are following the Ashes, and they were saying, they too agreed, they thought it was really good, but they were saying, let's just only have the one test per series where it is a day-night, and the others should be traditional. And I think that's probably not a bad idea. One thing that should also be said was, biggest ever crowd in Adelaide since 32-33 in the Bodyline series. Yeah. So obviously, again, if it's bringing punters through the gates, it's got to be a good move.
And it seemed like the atmosphere was fantastic there throughout the whole test. It seemed like, English supporters were getting into it. Everybody was enjoying it.
Yeah.
So I've got to get there one day, don't we?
Yeah, I've never actually been to a test match in Adelaide. So, I haven't done Sydney either. So I'd like to do that one day as well.
Yeah, it was an interesting contest too, until perhaps the last morning.
I think it was the session before when Milan got out the night before, because that was a wicket at a crucial point in the match. And then, of course, losing a wicket, second ball, I think it was, the next morning, the game was over then.
But I don't think Australia was in as much trouble as people made out at the end of that fourth day. I think that, they still were pretty much in the box seat, considering, England only bat to about seven. or seven or eight, round there somewhere. So, some of the cries coming out of England, I think Piers Morgan on Twitter would have had his tail between his legs.
Well, that's always a good thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, but, sometimes going the early crow is, not going to work out for you.
I think the thing is, if you look at it, is do England know what their best team is? And it appears to me that they don't. And I predicted before the tournament that I just couldn't see the England bowling attack bowling out Australia twice in a test. Anderson's record coming into Australia, his five wickets in that test was the first time he'd taken five wickets in Australia. And I just think he bowls too short over here.
Interesting you mentioned Jimmy Anderson, because he was just being praised as one of the greatest bowlers ever following that performance. Now, he is a very good bowler, do not get me wrong, but if Jimmy Anderson was ever going to take five wickets, it was that evening. Now, the thing about Jimmy is he's been a brilliant, brilliant cricketer over a long period of time, and he's getting near the end. And that was shown up by what happened in the first innings, when that was a time to be pulling out your best. That first morning and doing what you had to do and digging deep, not when conditions absolutely 100% suited you. So that's, to me, says Jimmy's turned that corner and he's looking, as a top line level cricketer, his performances have now got to the point where he's got to be looked at serious as being dropped.
Look, I agree with you, and I think, you know, people go, yes, he's Britain's, or England's rather, leading wicket taker of all time. That is a hell of an achievement.
Hell
is
yeah.
He, in my opinion, one of England's greatest bowlers? No. I think I've seen better bowlers than him. I think Bob Willis was a better bowler than him. I think if you look back, I mean, obviously Fred Truman's before my time, but I think there have been better bowlers than Darren Goff. I wouldn't have in that. I don't think he was an intelligent bowler. He was fairly quick, but he was erratic. But I think there have been better bowlers. Probably Jimmy Anderson, and maybe I'm being a bit harsh, certainly wouldn't be in my top 10 bowlers in the world, but he might be in the probably top 5 for England as a quick bowler. But to me, he just doesn't do it enough outside of England. He does really well in England, but he can't get the wickets in other countries. So,
and his bowling in that second Australian innings was sensational. And that's what he's good at. That's his meat and potatoes, is in those sort of conditions. Because there's plenty of blokes in the same conditions wouldn't have been able to do what he did. But you've got to be able to do it. The frontline test fast bowler, you've got to be able to bring that when things are against you as well.
See, that's where I think Australia actually lacks a little bit in, or Stark. Now, everybody raves about Mitch Stark as being, again, a really great, venomous, fast bowler. But I think Cummins is a far better bowler a country mile. And look, Stark ripped through the tail to win the test match. That's what you expect a fast bowler to do. But does he get enough top order wickets? I don't know. I think maybe he's still got to prove himself to convince me. But Cummins to me is quality.
Remember our interview with his name leaves me just for the moment. The twins, Alec Bedser.
Yeah.
And he made that comment about fast bowlers getting the number 11 out and charging down the wicket in celebration. And you know, well, mate, you're supposed to get him out.
Absolutely.
Don't celebrate it. That's your job.
No, absolutely. Well, anyway.
And on that, I think Stark's a little bit like Broad, but not as flaky. If things aren't exactly going Stark's way, he struggles.
No,
and
I agree.
Broad is definitely struggles if it's not absolutely set up for him.
No, I agree. And I think, again, there's a player that's reached the end.
Yeah. It's a pity his batting has gone downhill too. I think he got hit in the head at some stage a few years ago. And when you look at his test scores and his batting, from that point on, it's all downhill, which is a real, you know, pity. Because he could bat.
He's been a very good player for him, but I think he's just reaching the end now.
Much as we hate him in Australia. No, we don't really, Chris.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, we are on Not the Footy Show, and it's time for our first guest. And this week we're catching up with Matt Hender, who is a player, well, he was a player in volleyball, played overseas, comes from Western Australia, and then when he returned, he found himself coaching UWA, and that's when we spoke to him earlier in the year when the team were heading off to Japan to play in a tournament there. But since then, Matt has taken on the reins of the WA Hornets and really reversed their fortunes in the Australian Volleyball League, so we thought we'd better catch up with him again and find out the secret of his success. Matt Hender, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ash. It's good to be back again.
Well, it's been a while since we caught up, and I think the last time we spoke, UWA were heading off to Japan to play in the tournament up there, and you did really well, actually. You came in 11th playing against the top 20 teams.
Yeah, I mean, that was, 6 months ago now, but yeah, we had a good tournament. We took a really young team, and it was a massive experience for a lot of young players, and, you know, Tokyo hosted a really good tournament, and we had a good time, and yeah, a lot's changed since then.
I did read your assistant coach saying that he felt that a lot of the players came back knowing how much work they had to do to be on a par with the rest of the teams. Is that, do you think, one of the benefits of a trip like that?
I think definitely, we were exposed to volleyball that was on a completely different level. So I think the guys, you know, made them, you know, excited and hungry for the season, which led into an interesting season with the WA Volleyball League. So yeah, it was a good foundation to start us off.
Well, you've since taken on the reins of the WA Hornets in the Australian Volleyball League. How did that come about? I mean, because last time we spoke, I don't think that was even on the cards.
Actually, it was something that I thought about early last year, and a lot of people pushed me to apply for the job, and Volleyball WA were looking for a new head coach, and you know, I kind of fell into it again. But yeah, it was, you know, for me a really, really good experience, and yeah, something that I won't forget.
An amazing season, really, when you consider that last year the Hornets came last in their pool in, what is it, the Southern group, but this time they came top. So how do you attribute the turnaround? Is it just your coaching?
Yeah, I mean, last year the Hornets were, you know, quite a weak team, and this year we changed a lot of things. I came in with a new assistant coach, and you know, we worked really, really hard. We changed a lot of things, and yeah, we ended up finishing with 10-2 in the Southern Conference, something that no team has done in the Southern Conference, and it's definitely something the Hornets never expected to do. So it's pretty exciting to be a part of.
I'm sure when you get that winning combination, that again, it just breeds that belief. Was that very much what it was like? And did you have a young team that sort of grew as the tournament grew?
Yeah, I mean, we started selections back in May, and, you know, I was literally starting from scratch. We had a lot of guys that had been involved with the Hornets for a while, and we had a lot of new guys that, you know, I felt could, you know, implement something into the team. And, you know, I was lucky enough to, you know, find and have the best players available. And, yeah, I think that, you know, I was able to pick the right players, and it really, you know, showed in the end.
The semi-final, you came up against Canberra Heat. Was that a game you were expecting to win, or was it a bit of a surprise when you got through to the grand final?
Yeah, the Heat are, you know, a very professional outfit. They have a lot more money than us over in the West, and they'd played in 5 or 6 grand finals previously against the Queensland Pirates, so we knew it was going to be a huge task for us. But I think, you know, the guys showed a lot of belief, and, you know, we just came out playing as aggressive as we could, and, you know, hats off to the guys. They, you know, they weren't scared, and we caused a massive upset in Australian volleyball, so it was really big for us.
It was going to be a big ask to cause an upset, though, in the grand final, wasn't it, against Queensland, who've been the dominant side in recent years, and also coming into the final had only dropped one game.
Yeah, the Pirates, you know, they're an, you know, amazing team. They've played together for 4 or 5 years, and they've got players that have played over professionally for many years in Europe. So we knew it would be a huge task, and, you know, we were, you know, as much as we were happy to be playing in the grand final, you know, we definitely still thought we had a chance. And, you know, even though we didn't win the match, we took so much more from, you know, the whole game as a whole, and you know, I was just really proud to be a part of, you know, the grand final.
You were the youngest coach in the competition. Was that something that preyed on your mind at any stage, or do you have that inner belief that, look, I'm good enough to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think age is, you know, something that people, you know, like to use as a kind of outcome measure for success in coaching. I think people like to think that experienced coaches usually come with age, and I totally agree with that. But I think what I brought to the team was, you know, leadership, and, you know, some uncanny kind of knowledge, which really, you know, helped the guys, you know, come with it. And It was really fun. Like, the whole experience was really a really good experience, and, you know, it's, you know, really made me hungry for next year. Yeah.
We touched on this last time we spoke, how your playing away from Australia and playing in Europe, it exposed you to new things within the game, new experiences, new training methods, and you brought those back to UWA. Was it, again, because of the success you had with UWA, there was that faith that, hang on a sec, this guy's been there, he knows what he's talking about, and age really doesn't matter?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to a lot of the guys in the beginning, and I think it took a while for most of the new players I hadn't worked with to buy into, you know, what I was all about. And, you know, they were unsure, and I think in the early stages I was also a little bit unsure of how it would all work. But the guy, yeah, hats off to the guys. They, you know, they believed in me, and, you know, they put everything on the table, and, you know, I can safely say that I improved every single player in the squad, and I think they would all agree too.
Do you think some of them have improved you as a coach as well?
Definitely. I mean, managing 20 guys of all ages teaches you a lot, and I think yeah, it's something that, you know, I'm going to keep learning to do, and, you know, I really see coaching as a pathway for me, and, you know, the guys, you know, have been just amazing. They've been, you know, super supportive of everything I've wanted to do, and, yeah, I can't thank them enough for, you know, trusting me in all of it.
So the playing career now is completely gone.
I'm actually asked this question quite a lot, and I think right now I'm really enjoying the coaching side of things, and, you know, there hasn't been too many times where I really miss playing, but I think if I was to walk away from the sport altogether, then I would miss it. So I'm not going to say that, you know, coaching is the be-all and end-all, but, yeah, I'm happy doing it for now.
Do you register yourself as a player when you're coaching, just in case, you know, the injuries you might be required?
Yeah, I was actually going to write my name on the list for the grand final just so I could get on the court, but no, I'm kidding. It was, no, I don't register myself, and I like to back my players, and, you know, I was really confident that they could, you know, get the job done all season, which they did, and, you know, we've got so many exciting things for 2018, and I can't wait to be a part of it.
Can the Hornets go all the way in 2018?
I think definitely we have the players to do it. We're working on a few things at the moment, trying to make the team actually quite more of a full-time environment. We'll be the first team to offer a full-time kind of outlook on the whole season. So we're going to sit down with Volleyball West Australia and figure out how we can make this a full-time training, so we can get the gold for next year and, you know, start something bigger than anyone else.
And I believe that you're trying to set up now an agency to get players the opportunity to go and get a college volleyball course in America or even in Canada.
Yeah, so it's a new project that I've been putting together for the last few months. I'm hoping to launch it in early January. It'll be called Volley Link, and it'll be focused purely on young Australian players looking to go and study over in Canada or America, so the CIS or NCAA. And it's something that is really exciting for Australian volleyball, and it's really exciting for me to be a part of because, you know, it's something that I was lucky enough to be a part of and pursue myself, and I really want to open the door for some juniors out there and, you know, try and, you know, bring more strength to our national team eventually. So, yeah.
I would presume that there are some players here with talent, but they're not good enough yet for that college system in the US. Is it a case of then you'll help them to get to that level so that they can get into the system?
Yeah, I mean, the players that are based in Perth, we've identified all the good juniors, so I'm slowly working with each of them, and hopefully I can get them up to the level. But for the players outside of Perth that I do work with, you know, I'll be, you know, trying to give them the right direction of what level and what kind of league or conference they're good enough to play at, and, you know, hopefully being that link to coaches over in North America for them.
And how do you do that? Is it a one-on-one coaching session, or is there a little bit of self-assessment and they have to mark themselves on the internet so you can keep an eye on them? Because there's so many different ways now of keeping tabs on young players.
Yeah, I think for the most part, the Perth players, I'll look to, you know, try and invite them along to sessions with myself, or work alongside their coaches and give them advice on how they can get up to the level. But for the players Australia-wide, I'll obviously have to watch video and, you know, try and steer them in the right direction of, you know, what they need to improve to get to that level. So it'll be exciting and a lot more learning for myself.
And the other thing I would have thought is if we get these young players getting these opportunities in America, with that will then again come publicity, because it is a great achievement for them to get there if they're successful, and that's going to grow the sport even more in Australia.
Yeah, definitely. I think we need people, you know, pushing players overseas. You know, the Australian Volleyball League's a good level, but, you know, we've got, you know, so many good players here, and they're going to waste, to be honest, Ash. You know, there's a lot of players, 18, 19, that, you know, play some good high school volleyball, and then there's no other option for them. So I think, you know, if I can set this up in the right way and, you know, be that kind of leader for them and someone that they can, you know, turn to and say, hey, I want to go play overseas, and, you know, give them the option instead of having no option at all.
It's funny that you say that, because I've actually met two people in the last year who were part of the junior development programs here, represented WA, and they dropped out at the age you said, 18, 19, because they said they just felt there was no direction, there was nowhere for them to go. Do you think they're now sort of around their late 20s, early 30s, but do you think things have improved since then?
Yeah, I think Volleyball Australia is doing a really good job. They've still got the AIS, or the Centre of Excellence, over in Canberra, but, you know, that's only for 20 out of the 100 kids, you know, so the top 20 get to go and train full-time, but what about the rest of them? And I really want to be that guy that can help the rest of the guys that don't get an opportunity, and eventually, you know, open that up to, like, helping women as well. But right now it'll be, you know, a junior male focus, and, you know, let's see where I can take it.
Well, Matt, fantastic. The one thing that always comes through is your enthusiasm for the sport.
Yeah, thanks, Ash. You know, volleyball, unfortunately, not unfortunately, but, you know, fortunately takes up a lot of my time and, you know, a lot of my thought process, and I'm passionate about it. And, I'm really excited for the next, you know, 6 months, and where UWA will be, where Hornets will be, where my agency will be, and we'll see from there.
Well, hopefully we'll catch up with you again in 2018.
Sounds good, Ash. Take care. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, that was Matt Hender, who is the coach of the WA Hornets, and as we heard, they managed to not only go from last place on the Southern Conference, but to first place, and also make it through to the grand final of the Australian Volleyball League. And we congratulate Matt, who is the youngest coach in the competition, and also all the players from WA, who obviously were prepared to listen to the young coach and put into practice what he was trying to do. Also like to congratulate him, John, on the fact that he's saying he's set up this agency now to try and get players, Australian volleyball players, into the college system in North America, in Canada and the USA. And that's only going to enhance the game as a whole in this country. And obviously great to give those players that opportunity.
Absolutely. And it's good to see we're leading the way again in another sport. Can't keep us Aussies down, can you?
Well, we'll have to wait and see about that. I don't know if Australia's up to the top level as yet, but at least WA's back in the mix in Australia.
Oh, yeah, it's good to see.
Well, the next topic, yeah, I want to touch on this, and you and I have talked about it off air a few times. And you raised it, in fact, I think it was a few podcasts ago, when you said how interchange, I think you were referring in the main in hockey,
yeah,
was taking out the fatigue factor and was basically evening the playing field amongst teams and making it just a case of, you know, it didn't matter who was the fittest team and who'd done the best preparation, because it was just easier because you can put on a fitter player or one with a bit of energy when one gets tired. And we're seeing that, to be honest, in rugby union as well, with their substitutions as well now, that it's not about the fittest. It used to be, you know, like the props couldn't run after about an hour. Now you just switch them and they keep going. I think we're seeing it now, and it really concerns me. We're seeing it in more and more sports. We saw the Super Sixes come into the Cricket World Cup, which, to me, it just prolongs the inevitable. Hasn't really made a big difference in the way or the teams that make it through to the semi-finals. Just seems to be something that they've done either for TV to fill airtime or whatever. I think we're also now seeing FIFA with the World Cup are looking, obviously, to expand that. They want to go up to 42 teams, and that concerns me again, because is it about quantity rather than quality? And I just think that, you know, there are teams that are going to be going to World Cup finals when it expands to 42 that aren't necessarily the best teams, would probably never have got there before, and they're only getting to the World Cup for the simple fact that we're expanding it to 42 teams. And now if we turn our attention to a sport that you love, John, which is hockey, and we've just seen it with the Hockey World League, what we're seeing is, you know, we're having pool games, and then all of the teams from the pool games went through to the quarterfinals, which you sort of think, well, why didn't you just make it knockout from the word go? Just pull them out of a hat and say, okay, guys, you're straight into the quarterfinals. You get knocked out if you lose these games. The pool games just became irrelevant, and you just felt that teams really, were they playing to their full potential in those pool games, or were they looking towards the fact that they knew they had to peak when it got to the quarterfinals, semifinals? There were three games they had to win, and the pool games were not so important because everybody was going to go through. I just think what is happening now is we're rewarding mediocrity rather than trying to push for excellence. And as a sports fan, I want to see the best teams performing to the best of their ability in every game they play. And I just feel with the expansion of the Football World Cup to 42, with, you know, Super Sixes in the cricket and this quarterfinal system we've just seen in the Hockey World League, we're not getting that. We're seeing teams holding things back because don't need to play at that level, and that upsets me.
Certainly during the Hockey World League finals, the pool stage was pretty average. I mean, a lot of games didn't really kick off until the last quarter, when probably the innate competitor in every player kicks in when they say, oh yeah, there is, well, pride, name it whatever you like, and suddenly the game's kicked off when it looked, a result was needed. I think the number of drawn games during the pool says a lot, that the teams weren't striving in that last few minutes to get the goal perhaps necessary. They didn't matter if they drew in a pool game. There was no consequence for losing whatsoever or drawing a game. Look at Australia. They drew their three pool games. Now, in any normal tournament, you'd miss the cut, mate. You wouldn't be playing quarters or semis.
And they should miss the cut. Absolutely. Let's be honest. I mean, we've seen now two Hockey World Leagues. India have claimed the bronze medal by winning one game in normal time.
Yeah.
And to me, that's not good for sport. Because you're rewarding teams that, well, they're standing on the podium having won one game in a tournament. And that cannot be right in any situation. And you're seeing it, though. I think what it is the elite teams, or sorry, the top teams in world sport have got too far ahead of the next tier. And if you look at it in English football, same thing really there, yeah, is we used to see the, and everyone goes on about the romance of the FA Cup. Doesn't really happen now. It's not that often that a team from the lower divisions ends up beating a Premier League team. It's very, very rare these days for that to happen. And even for sometimes, they might beat a Championship team, a team from Division 2 or Division 1. You're seeing, though, obviously a lot of teams from the non-league will beat a team from Division 1 and 2. That's still happening. But to see a team from the lower two divisions beating a team from the Premier League, that's really rare. I mean, my team, Swindon, I think we got to the fourth round of the FA Cup in 1980, drew Tottenham Hotspur that particular season, got to the semi-finals of the League Cup. Now, that's never going to happen, or it's not going to happen until we start climbing up the league ladder. And I think that what we're trying to do now is manipulate competitions for those things to happen by the way the competitions are structured. But that's not what sport's about. We're compromising the quality of the game, and we're not rewarding those teams that have invested, that have actually worked hard to be the best.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in the situation that hockey finds itself in, I think you'll find that there's a feeling that you've got to maximise the number of games India plays, because India's the big television drawing nation, and that's where all the viewers' eyes are going to be goggling, and that's where the money's going to come from television broadcast rights. So if you haven't got India playing in your finals, you're going to struggle. And they need them playing in the finals. And the only way they can get India playing finals is to have a system where they're automatically going to play. They would not have played in the Hockey World League finals had it been a normal system. Same as Australia would have missed out. And yet one team finishes third and the other team wins the competition.
But do you feel then...
It must be pointed out as well, despite all of these criticisms we're making of it, and which are pretty valid in my opinion, the number one and two ranked nations in the world still played the final.
Absolutely.
So,
and changed places on the world rankings.
So despite the fact we're sitting here saying the system doesn't work, it's interesting that you could argue it actually did.
But the cream will always rise to the top, let's be honest.
Yep.
When it matters. And I mean, this is a big thing, and you touch on that and you mention the India thing, and I've been arguing this for a long time when I've worked in India, is as much as India have progressed since the London Olympics in world hockey, they still haven't beaten in major tournaments. Now, I'm not talking like Hockey World League. They beat Belgium, obviously, this time in a shootout. They beat the Netherlands in a shootout 2 years ago to win the bronze medal there, and they beat Great Britain in the quarterfinals 2 years ago. But what in major tournaments, like we're talking Champions Trophy, we're talking World Cup, we're talking Olympics, India has not managed to beat the likes of Belgium, Holland, Germany, Australia.
It's
top teams when it matters in a really meaningful competition.
You did mention they beat Belgium in this tournament. That game was played in pouring rain, and while the game was on, I made comments on the old social media sphere that this that evens it up for the teams. And now it's going to come back to some things like basic skill set, desire, who's got the bigger mongrel in them. It had nothing, that result wasn't a reflection of the skills and abilities of both teams in perfect conditions.
And very true.
It was probably India's, those conditions were probably India's best chance to beat Belgium.
Well, and let's be honest, great spirit by Belgium to come back in that game because it looked as if they'd lost it. But the thing that was good for me is, and you can ask any coach who's coached India, India always say they'll lose when it's raining. So for them to get a result like that when it was raining was a phenomenal effort.
Which leads us back to the fatigue factor, because that game was a slog for the players. And even though, yes, they are super fit, and if it had been a fine day, they would have all run that game out sweet, and they would have all been smiley, jokey afterwards. But so, some of those players are actually knackered at the end of that game, and that's what I found pleasing, is that it took it out. Fatigue became a factor in the game, and it should. Fatigue should be a factor in sport.
Well, credit must go to the Germans, though, in their third-place playoff game, because they only had 11 fit players, and certainly they were fatigued at the end of the game. And those 11 players, the reserve goalkeeper had to play up front and scored,
and
which
scored
we believe
a goal.
Is possibly the first time a goalkeeper's ever scored in international hockey. But Germany, that was a phenomenal achievement by them, and just shows what a fighting team they are. And I thought it was very interesting, Mats Grambusch saying after the game that he feels that this will have really pulled them together as a unit, and they're going to be a force in a couple of years.
Oh, look, and the Australians got the best of the Germans, and you could argue it was because of the sickness. You know, they lucked in when they drew them, not taking anything away from Australia, and same with India, not taking anything away from the Indians, but they were lucky to get away with a 2-1 win over a team that only had 11 players.
Now, just before we wrap this and get to our last guest, I'm going to ask you a question. I listened to your podcast, The Reverse Stick, and there was an article came out about the water conditions in Bhubaneswar and the problems there. But now, with hindsight, because your podcast came out before all the sickness happened at the Hockey World League, and we saw all the German players go down, the Dutch had players down, England had players down. And to me, I think there is a massive question here. The World Cup is due to be played there next year. You cannot, John, have a tournament that is going to be dictated to the success of it by who can keep 18 fit players to be able to compete. It would be a great, great shame if the tournament is decided and teams go out purely because they have so many players down with illness, if that's the case. Now, just to add one thing, I checked on whose responsibility the duty of care is on that with a lawyer, and they said the way it works is the host nation has a duty of care on all of those players to make sure that there is no illness and all of those things, that everything is in place. And that goes not just to players, it goes to coaching staff, goes to media, everything. Their safety and their health is meant to be guaranteed, or to as, you know, the extent that you can guarantee it. And then on top of that, the FIH, or the governing body if it was another sport, then also have a duty of care, because they have already approved that the host nation has all of those things in place. So if anything does fall over and you get what we've had here, which we don't know, it's been said that it was food in the hotels, who knows what the real reason was, but it was a concern that it was three teams badly affected, and therefore you can't just cast it off, I don't think, as a one-off thing. And I know that we've seen this in other tournaments held in that region where there have been issues. But to me, it'll be really sad if the World Cup is implicated in such a way.
Oh, definitely. I think we've got to be a little bit careful in the way we look at this, in the sense that we've just seen a cruise ship going around Australia from a lovely first world nation, and the whole cruise has been a schmozzle because everybody's got sick, some bugs got on board, and it spread itself around. So these problems aren't necessarily just to do with India. You can have that happen anywhere at any time.
I accept that. Yep. But I mean, when you know there are issues with the water there, and you can't just say, and as you were touching on, well, you drink bottled water, but then people forget when they're brushing their teeth. They're in the shower and they may get water in their mouth there, that you don't know how fruit and vegetables have been washed, in the kitchen. So, you know, there are a whole lot of other things that you don't get in first world countries. Now, I'm not saying don't have the tournament in India, but I'm just saying that we cannot have a tournament as important as the World Cup that could be affected by such a thing.
What makes me worry more is that there's stuff going into the water that's going to show up in tests. And you know, you can't blame India or Indian authorities when individuals do stupid things like tip shit into the river that they shouldn't tip in there. And we've seen what happened with athletes in China and other parts of the world who claim that they've eaten something tainted. Now, some of them get away with it. Some of them, the authorities say, nah, mate, you're going to cop it for this one. That, to me, is more of a worry than someone picking up Giardia and being crook for a couple of days. As bad as it is for the sport and the tournament and the teams, that could potentially happen anywhere. Whereas some of these other things that you might pick up that 6 weeks down the track when Asada comes knocking on your door, you might be in trouble.
The one thing I do advocate is I think the FIH needs to look at this now in the next 2 months to try and find a way to make sure it doesn't happen again. Now, that is the big thing I think that Hockey India and the FIH need to go in there, have an independent investigation into it, and come out with a report, and also what they're going to do to try and ensure, because as you say, you can never be 100% sure that there is nothing like this happens at the World Cup.
It's interesting, though, I'd only got a couple of teams.
Three teams.
And I
believe that the England players were very, very sick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it wasn't just diarrhea. They were really very, very sick. I was talking to the England team manager, so it wasn't just a light DMV. It was a lot worse than that.
Okay. Oh, I had a bit of that going on yesterday, so
thanks,
I
thanks, John. We don't really need to know that.
Do feel sympathy for the players. If you've got another interview, maybe I'll just play this first.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are listening to Not the Footy Show, our last podcast of the year. And we thought it appropriate that we should round out the year with a man who's been a great servant to Australian hockey, and he's hung up his stick just short of the 200 cap mark, and that is, of course, wonderful drag flicker and defender for Australia, Chris Sorello. Chris Sorello, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Great to be back to Not the Footy Show. Very excited to be back and talk to the great man himself.
Well, sadly, you've announced your international retirement. Was that an easy decision to come to?
No, not the easiest decision. I've obviously played for a long time. I started playing hockey when I was 4 years old. It's been a big part of my whole life, travelling the world and being supported by my family and friends. It wasn't an easy decision to step away from that team morale and building, really being a part of things is not that great. But if you're not up for selection, it's pretty easy to make a decision, and that was my decision in the end to step away and retire.
Was there communication between the coaching staff today and yourself? Like, were they giving you a sort of opening that there was a possibility to come back, or did they say, look, you're not part of our plans?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a push for over the last year, working through both AHLs. Yeah, there was definitely an opportunity to play, come back. Obviously, winning back-to-back AHLs and equivalent this year was, I drew equal highest goal scorer, but last year was a highest goal scorer as well. And to be captain of the Victorian team and win, it's obviously puts your foot forward to be able to be up for selection. I was told otherwise that I wasn't up for selection, and I accept that, as I've done many a coaching position, and that's a hard, difficult decision, but I understand in the end it falls on your head as a coach. That's why you get title of head coach, and yeah, I wish them all the best.
Must have been disappointed that you didn't quite get to the 200 games for the Kookaburras.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's an individual goal. Looking at cracking 200, you know, you're in a pretty important group. But playing 195 games, there was a few there that weren't credited as caps anyway due to playing too many players. And I'm sure if you speak to Rick in the near future, he'll get, you know, his head all hotted up about that. But no, I'm playing 200, yeah, it's pretty amazing. 195 is still, you know, you compare that to any other international team like rugby or... That's a phenomenal amount of games.
Certainly is. Now, you were talking there about the AHL and obviously your performance there. Do you feel that hockey's in a good position, that there are players coming through to replace you?
I think it's only a matter of time eventually, and I understand it doesn't matter what sport you play or business, there's going to be an end point. I've come to that realisation that, yeah, I still had the ability to perform. However, change of guard and other people to step in that position, I think there'll be a bit of a handover, a changeover, which might take a little while. But in the end, it's about, you know, stepping up to the plate and playing. And I think the biggest test is obviously when you run through finals and under pressure. It's always easy to play during the smaller games and leading in, but it's stepping up when you're needed.
There's a lot of countries in hockey that the Olympics is the big one. That's the medal everybody wants. And so they look at their transition periods over a four-year period. As a commentator, I look at it and I think that's wrong. I think it should be maybe done in two-year increments, because there may be players like yourself who possibly could have come around for another 2 years, had something to offer the team, but because you're not going to be probably there for the Olympics, you've been discarded. Do you feel that maybe this four-year cycle is sometimes working to the detriment of international teams?
Yeah, absolutely. What I realise, and when you cut so the amount of players that we had as such a strong group, the Australian team for so long, sitting at number one in the world, the training load and the training quality has to drop. And so when you're only training against other guys that are playing in the same sort of league, you're not pushing yourself, I believe. I understand, though, for people, someone trying to get a job, it comes down to you fulfilling an interview role, and you have your points that you think you can commit to, and, you know, change is what people are always about. And once you've made those promises, I think you've got to try to fulfil them, whichever way that goes. So I think there's a lot you can do with it, but it's hard. It comes back to how the training load is, I think.
I'm going to take you back now to the very beginning, and I mean, hockey runs through your family history, and was it always going to be hockey, but were you good at other sports as well?
Yeah, I played a lot of different sports growing up. I was in first 11 cricket, first 18 football, played volleyball in the seconds at Mazenod College over in Melbourne, which is the equivalent of the Australian team back then. So they were a phenomenal volleyball school. They've got a professional set up there now for international volleyball. So they've really carried that school. So I did plenty of other stuff. I did karate, kickboxing. We did, played a bit of rugby. I was part of the chess club. I was a captain of one of the houses. I was in the athletics team. Yeah, the only thing I don't do, mate, is swim very well.
So that actually backs up the point that, you know, there's a big argument today that we're making children specialise way too young. If you listen to all the sports you played, I'm sure they contributed to having a vision on the pitch, a physicality on the pitch, and various other attributes as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think you can pick up little bits and pieces, but it depends on the person, whether they're willing to take those points on. Like, I know, looking at soccer and stuff, and you see their one-touch play and the way they have their vision and their body open and all the rest of it, that's no different to hockey. But you can see the process of from a junior is how quickly you can do the skills and execute them. So if you're struggling, you should really just look back at the skills, because they don't change from whether you're an under-9 hockey player or an Australian hockey player. It's just how quick and how your quality of skills are in the basics.
I remember when I was writing Australia's Hockey Grail, you said to me how when you were playing as a junior, you used to beat these teams, but if you conceded a goal, was it your dad was really mad at you because there was a defensive error and it should have been a clean sheet? Do you think, again, that competitive edge and that striving for perfection came from your dad?
It was more my grandfather. So my grandfather actually coached my dad, and that's how my parents met. But my grandfather coached me. In 1 year, we played for Springvale Noble Park, which is predominantly Anglo-Indian sort of club. We hit 201 goals for and 4 against. So those 4 goals, being the main defender at the back, were my fault. And when they scored, every goal hurt. So, yeah, I definitely think having a competitive group, and that's what is really needed, a competitive training group to be able to push you to excel and, I think, to step up to the next level. And if you're cruising along at training, then I used to get a rocket then, and it's no different from probably when I got to the Australian team with Barry Dancer, Rick and everyone else.
Was your grandfather a major part in your forming you as a player?
Yeah, I think so. I think what I've always looked at is where I can improve. Like, you can always have a lot of good touches, but it was always the bad ones that I got shown up on the car or told on the way home. So the grass ground we originally started playing on was close to where they actually used to live. So he used to actually walk back with him with your stick and your shin pads. And I remember the walks, and he would actually give you a roasting for that pass you missed, or that positional position where you should have been or where you weren't, or that missed tackle or a corner you gave away, which wasn't a lot when you win some games by 25-0. However, every little incident counted to him, and I think that's what I look at now, even when I do my coaching. You got to look at what you do well, great, but it's where you can improve and step to the next level.
When did you get into drag flicking? I mean, was that something that you started as a junior, or was it something that when you physically became stronger, someone said, hey, you should have a go at this?
No, I started when I was 11. There's a guy who played seniors, so I started playing seniors when I was actually 11 years old too. And that was with a father-son team. So that's where I learnt my positional play and where to stand and what to do. Also playing against older players, I needed to be smarter. And that's what I really make sure I coach, is how to be smarter. Because if you're not as fast and you're not as strong, you've got to start to outthink your opponent. So there was a guy that I played senior hockey with who used to flick off the bunt. So they used to trap it, knock it in, and he'd flick it off the head of the stick. And he could flick it in any corner. And he would have been 30 then, and I was 11. And I said, oh, I'm going to be flicked better than you. And he said, no, you won't. And I looked at him, I said, yes, I will. He goes, you got no chance. And I trained. I remember being 11, 12. We had, when even my father and the stuff were trained for veterans, I'd be out there practicing with drag flicking and looking at different technique and working through what I needed to work through. And eventually, I just started picking it up, and I couldn't flick it high. That's what I teach kids. You don't necessarily have to flick high. If you flick it in the net, it's worth one goal. You flick it in the hits of backwards, still worth one goal. In the end of the day, you still get your name in the paper. So a big focus for me was about getting the technique right, and that's what I've been teaching elsewhere. If you get the technique right, the strength will come, and then you don't put your body at issue of injury.
How important was it at that age to be playing with older players? I mean, we see again, there's a lot of thought, schools of thought, that children shouldn't be playing up above their age groups. I personally did, and I think it helped me a hell of a lot. Did it help you? It sounds as if it did.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I played, even cricket, I played in my old man's team. So I was fielding out there, and I had a bat, and you had guys bowling. So again, it gets rid of your scare factor. It makes you actually want to think and be out there. And also, it teaches you not to put yourself in a position where you can get hurt. So it only makes you a better player in the long run, I think. Big issue with a lot of kids, and I've said this to some people in Victoria, Queensland, and here in Perth, is what happens is kids grow up, they play against their own age group, they're the best of their best, and then they step into the real world. And they haven't had that ability to compete against someone that's better than them, faster than them, and stronger than them, and then they fall by the wayside. So it's the same as when you finish school and you step into a real life job, you're not going to just get the easy butter up, oh, it's okay, you have the job this time. It doesn't work like that. So I think it's imperative to be able to play and understand that it pulls you back to the level. I've seen some kids that have too high belief, I think, in themselves. And again, I think they'll be knocked down a few pegs come a few more years when they actually step into proper senior hockey.
Going back to your drag flicking, and you were saying about keeping it low, was there, again, just an immense confidence? And did that confidence when you were drag flicking come from the hours of practice? Or was it just from having studied goalkeepers and done your homework?
Definitely hours of practice. So come finals is where you want to perform. And the least thing you want to worry about is whether you got your technique right, whether you're going to be able to push it or do anything in that, execute that skill. So for me, it was, all the years I've done. But just embracing and relaxing and saying, I've been through this 100 times, how can I perform and execute the skill?
2014, you had what I think is got to be a rare occurrence, 3 hat-tricks in 3 finals, Aslan Shah, the World Cup and the Commonwealth Games. I mean, do you look back on that as being one special year?
Yeah, I do. It was pretty special. Again, like for me, corners are great and they win you tournaments, I think. Same as a good goalkeeper can save you a tournament. Aslan Shah, I got 4 corners, scored 4 goals. Interesting stories when I tell some of the kids when I coach is that I broke my favourite stick in that final, in the warm-up. It broke in the handle and I'd shattered because I've always gone back to that stick for probably 7 years. So when that happened, I had to get a brand new stick. Went to that stick, had to get it all passed, hadn't gripped it or anything. So I ran off, had hardly a warm-up in Aslan Shah. Came on, had 4 corners, scored 4 goals. So I was pretty pumped. I said, this stick better be my stick that I stay with for a while. So I stayed with that. I stuck with that stick and then just became more confident in it as well. Confident in your body and your position, and executing the skill. And again, like I said, I couldn't have done it without the rest of the team, being able to push out and trap and win the corners in the first place. But if that's your role to be able to execute and do, and lucky enough, 2014, I did that. World Cup, I did that, and then Commonwealth Games was another one, 3 corners, 3 goals. So I was lucky enough in 2014, by the time I played finals, World League final, where I scored 2 seconds ago against Belgium, was 11 goals from 12 corners. So not a bad average.
No, not bad at all. I mean, you've mentioned all the success, or some of the successes you've had, such as winning the World Cup, but I would think the elusive one was the Olympics, and I'm sure when you look back now, you have retired, that there's almost a little bit of if only, and I would think a huge amount of disappointment, because that team you really feel should have got to the gold medal game.
Oh, absolutely. You look back at the stats alone, and I've won every tournament bar the Olympics with a gold medal, not just won a medal. So the belief in the team was great. But it's also drive me now every day to realise that the one thing I didn't win was the one we should have won as well. But tournaments and sports are funny things. It's how you perform on the day, whether you step up and do all the hard work, whether you click, and then you got the external factors that can affect you, whether it be food, accommodation, sickness, injuries, blah, blah, blah. So all these other things, the things that you can control, things you can't control, and, you know, you're relying on at least 15 other players to be able to compete together to win. And it only takes one moment or one mishap for someone to score a goal and then flood their circle or flood their 25. So it's for me, a great learning experience, and I've taken so much from it myself. And I really take that on board to all the coaching and even business and stuff that I'm looking into doing in my whole life, because you work so hard for it's not one tournament. It's 4 years, or for me, 8 years of hard work to be able to play after losing a couple of games in 2 years, being the semi-final of the Olympics in London, and then the pre-Olympic tournament we lost to Germany as well. So we didn't lose many games, and out of 195, I don't know how many we lost, but we're in about less than 30, which is frustrating. But, you know, like I said, it takes a team to be able to step up and perform, and it's just a matter of executing. And you can have, like I say to when I coach, the best defenders, best goalkeeper, best midfield, best strikers, but if you don't score, it's all irrelevant.
Does that prove the point that sometimes you learn more from defeat than you do from victory?
People say yes. I think you should just be learning anyway. All I've done with hockey and stuff is great, but what I look at is that's got to me where I am now, and what I need to do is keep moving and keep pushing along. So whether it be life or hockey, for me it's always about learning something and developing something. And I think that's, yeah, you can definitely learn from a loss because you decide to look into it more. But every game that I've ever played for Australia, I'd go through every clip and every touch I had and look at where I went wrong. So then can I fix it in that situation that worked? So then look at the situations and map out in your mind from that situation. Have I got A and have I got B? So can I do both? So that's the position I got to. So when A was closed, do I have B? And then if B is closed, do I have C? So in my head, I look at patterns and all the rest of it so I can understand what's happening, where people are and where people feel uncomfortable. So I got to that point for myself to actually understand what I could do. So it was a lot of hard work, but in the end, if you're lucky enough, myself, score 115 goals for your country, you take every single one of them.
Is there one that stands out more than any other?
Well, in the Olympics, I hit a Tomo goal, field goal, which is fantastic. A few strokes. The one in Belgium, I really like scoring. There was one in Commonwealth Games against India in India. 25,000 screaming Indian fans banging the net. I couldn't hear someone call for the ball. Got a corner, flicked it above. Bharat Chetri was the captain of India then, who's a good mate of mine in India. Flicked it above his right shoulder, and it was a rocket. So that really sticks with me. And obviously, World Cup, flicking a hat-trick there. Flicking a hat-trick in Commonwealth Games. Yeah. I think being able to perform on big stages, as other guys say, and Orchin, all the other guys that have commentated, it's where you get your most fun.
You've touched on in this conversation that, you know, when you're coaching now, is that where you're going down that path? Is the coaching path the one where you want to put back in the game? It sounds like you really enjoy it as well.
Yeah, I do. We've been coaching a lot across the country, in Melbourne, Queensland, Perth, a bit all over the place. What I really like to see is, and that's what we do, is we film a kid, for example, and look at their strengths and weaknesses then, and then with a training program, look back and assess how far they've grown. And it's like anything, you know, for a parent looking at that and seeing how much they've grown and how much they've improved has been phenomenal. So we took 36 kids to the FHE Cup just recently. We tried to look at the top, from 20 to 50, so kids that haven't been selected for state stuff. So to give them a chance to play, and they played against Japan, against Singapore, Malaysia, these type of teams, which are under 16 national teams. And the Japanese team have been viewed for 2024 Olympics, some of these kids. So they definitely can play. And we've had quite a few kids from the country, which was a big game for us to develop the Victorian country. And we had players from New South Wales, from Queensland and Victoria. So we put them all together. We had training loads. We had running programs. We had swimming programs. We had skills you had to execute. So there's a whole journey and a whole program that went with it. Got together, flew in, accommodation, flights, uniforms, all sorted. They flew in. We had a live-in chef, which is something I always wanted, but I didn't stay there, so I didn't get it. But that was all looked after. They had the best experience, and we've had unbelievable feedback from these kids and changed some of their lives. Because some of them hadn't actually done any fitness work or the rest of it. So that was a big goal for us to be able to change and improve.
And that's the Cirillo Coaching Academy. Is it restricted to Australia, or are you looking to go overseas with it as well?
No, we're definitely looking at going overseas. There's definitely some options. Looking to go through India. There's some stuff through Malaysia, I've heard as well. It's just a matter of being able to execute and find the time to be able to get everything sorted. And I think that's our big goal, is to be able to improve, link other coaches in, and develop not only kids but adults. I'm heading off to be able to go to the under 21 Australian group and teach them how to do drag flicking, both boys and girls.
Well, Chris, it's been good catching up, and we wish you all the best in your retirement.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Chris Cirillo from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, very appropriate, John, that you should play that. He is now retired from the Kookaburras, but what a servant he's been to the game.
Great drag flicker. The other thing about Chris is, yeah, he's got the drag flick, but he's got the standard flick as well. And some of his goals weren't the drag flick. They were just standing on the spot and letting it fly. And I think that is a better weapon than the drag flick. If you're a goalie, you can see a drag flick coming. Now, you may not react quick enough to get it, but you certainly know it's coming, and you can make yourself big and do all those sorts of things goalies do. And we saw Tyler Lovell pick up a couple in the Hockey World League final just by standing there making it big, and the flick went straight into his glove. But Cirillo had that off-the-spot flick, and that is really hard to pick because you don't. It just comes straight off the stick, and it's in the air, and it's flying past your head.
I did tell him that he is your poster boy on the reverse stick for the change to the rules for the low drag flick hit in the backboard.
What did he think?
Well, he goes, not so sure about that, because he said if they know that's going to happen, you're just going to get goalkeepers logging. And he goes, the height of goalkeepers today, it will make it very, very difficult to score.
That's the thing we're copping back to about. But it's the only criticism we're having of that idea.
Oh, look, I'm in favour of it. I'm with you. I think it is something that has to happen. Although the other thing that he said is he's very concerned that someone is going to get very seriously injured.
Oh, yeah.
Unless the rules are changed soon. Because he said it is just getting ridiculous.
And if you look at those face masks, I think they give you a false sense of security, because you wear one of those with the style that they sit on on your face like that, you're still going to wear one. It's still going to break your jaw. You won't get blood splattering everywhere.
Dr. Rick Charsworth has been fighting against those for a long time, because exactly what you're saying, he said they are tight against the face.
Yep.
And he goes, they'll still fracture your cheekbone. They will just push it in. You'll get a compressed fracture.
Yep.
And he said what they need to do is there needs to be, like a cricket helmet, a bit of space where it actually can shift on your head, but it won't necessarily. There's a little bit of give, and there's some space between your face and the protection.
And that's exactly what goalkeepers have on. Oboe's just released a new face mask for goalkeepers. It is essentially the same old softball catcher's face mask that they used to wear 20 years ago, just slightly redesigned and more ergonomic, but it's basically the same bit of kit. Anyway, let's hope it doesn't happen and the authorities make some changes before they're forced to.
Absolutely, but I'd just like to say to Chris Cirillo, thanks for the memories, mate.
Oh, absolutely. He was a fantastic player to watch, and a good fullback in the old school tradition of fullbacks. There was a brilliant piece of footage that came out from the last AHL where a forward's running down, he's coming through the D, you know, he's tried to get the ball past Cirello, and Cirello's used the old you or the ball, son, but not both.
Yeah, New South Wales didn't like that at all,
tell you. But fair tackle. As a fullback, that is a fair tackle.
but the one thing I would say again, and I'm not saying this just because obviously I'm friendly with it, but I do wonder whether Australia sometimes gets rid of players too quickly, because the one thing Cirello has learnt as he's got older and he's maybe slowed down a little bit is you don't have to run quite so hard, because you run intelligently, you close down angles, and you know, we've seen a lot of top defenders in a lot of sport, you don't have to always go with the man, because as you get clever you learn where to be, when to run, when to go, when to hold back. And I think, you know, maybe, I certainly think in the last couple of years he had that. Whether he was discarded too soon, well, we'll never know.
No, I get the feeling, though, that while you're right, and that maybe in a lesser team he could have played, but I think when you're looking at Australian hockey and certain elements that they expect from the players, I reckon he was a yard too slow. If they got him behind him, that was it. And you've got to be able to make those yards up these days. Okay, at that top level.
I'll ask you a question then here. So you've obviously got, and they're different players, but Mark Knowles is not exactly quick these days.
You can't carry two of them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So was it a decision, you think, between the captain and the Cirello?
It could very well have been.
Yeah.
I mean, he's still a brilliant player. And that's the thing about these international players. Okay, they might, you lose a yard of pace, so you're a bit slower, all that. But even when I'm 50 and you come up against those guys, and they're just as good as they were 30 years ago, mate.
Absolutely.
They're just not as quick.
Yeah, and the thing is, they use their heads. They're just smart. And that's what I'm saying is, they may lose a yard of pace, but their knowledge in their head that they can read the game so damn well, they don't need that yet.
I think there's too many forwards in the Netherlands team, in the German team, in the Argentinian team, the Spanish team, and a few other teams that would have just, they would have made life too difficult for him, because they would have played behind him and they would have just, he wouldn't have been able to cope. That's my theory.
Well, it's time for us
but
to head off.
Thank you for the memories, because he's a great player.
I was going to say, it's time for us to head off now. We hope you've enjoyed all of the podcasts for the last year. As I said, we'll be taking a bit of a break over Christmas and the New Year, and we'll be back probably about mid-January. But just go to notthefootyshow.com and also to our Facebook page, Not The Footy Show. If you'd like a guest featured, again, just contact us in the New Year and we'll try and fit you in. But thanks for listening. All the best for 2018.
And enjoy your Christmas sport.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.